Black Mother Goddess, Salt Dragon of Chaos, Sebolisa, Mawu, attend me. Hold me in your muscular, flowing arms. Protect me from throwing away any part of myself. There is no part of myself I need to deny or hide or get rid of. Black Mother is fierce. She challenges me to face myself and the power that lies in my darkness. At the same time, she nurtures me and invites me to nourish myself by allowing all of me to be. This gracious acceptance of self is truly empowering. So tonight what I want to talk about is a subject that's quite familiar to me and probably to many, if not all of you, and that's the internal judge or the internal critic. For me, this has been the greatest hindrance. There are five classical hindrances, and I've always said my hindrance of choice was doubt, and I think that's a direct result of the judge, that constant judging, constant monitoring has created an enormous amount of doubt over the years. So thinking about this, I'm reminded of the story, maybe many of you have heard, of the Dalai Lama several years ago when he was talking to a group of Western Buddhist teachers. And he asked them, as teachers in the West, what is the most challenging thing they face? What is the most difficult thing with their Western students? And someone spoke up and said, self-hatred, self-loathing, words to that effect. And he didn't know what she was talking about. And it took several times through the translator asking, what is this teacher saying? And then he went around to each teacher in the room, there were something like 50, and said, is that true for you? Is that true for you? Is that true for you? And without exception, they all said yes. And when he finally got that and understood, he wept. And I think that story stays with me and with other people, because we recognize it. We recognize the truth of that. That in our culture, there is so much criticism of ourselves, so much self-loathing. It's perhaps what brings many of us to practice. And thank goodness we do come to practice. So, when we think about the judge, what comes to my mind, and especially as Mark mentioned, I now am teaching meditation at Elmwood to a group of women inmates. It's very rewarding. And I think about them being in prison. They are physically imprisoned. But what about us? What about how we are kept prisoners of our mind? And I think one of the important ways that we are kept prisoners is this judging, is this constant evaluation, constant voice in our head, perhaps, evaluating, judging. Is this good? Is this not good? Am I doing okay? Am I looking okay? Am I not looking okay? Is this correct? Is this not correct? That constant commentary, I think, is a prison. It certainly was for me. So how did this judge come about? without placing blame, it's very important, it's very helpful to see how the judge got ingrained in us. And for most of us, it's very ingrained. It's a part of us. It's probably so much a part of us, we don't often see it. It just goes on constantly, and like the fish in water, we're not even aware of it. But it's important to see where it came from, because when we recognize that, then we see that it was not innate. It's not a part of our nature. It happened. And usually what we discover is that it was from one or more important adults in our growing up. Perhaps one or both parents, perhaps some other significant adult or adults in our lives. That while probably well-intentioned, not always, but sometimes, left us with this unending doubt, this unending criticism of ourselves. For some parents, probably there was a feeling, I know in my case, I'm sure, there was a thought that that if you praise a child, then that'll just create conceit. And the way to teach them is to constantly be pointing out what they're doing wrong. That's how they learn. So it was well-intentioned, but it certainly had an extremely powerfully damaging effect. So to see that, to see how that judge got instilled, and to understand that at the time, as children, it was effective. Having that judge was probably very useful. It helped us. Its point was, and it helped us to, stay within bounds, to act correctly, to fit in, to not cause too much of a stir. And in some cases, it may actually have been life-saving. Many of the strategies that we develop as children are literally life-saving. They are a way to get along in the situation we're in as children. The unfortunate thing is that they become so ingrained and so instilled in us, and then as we mature into adulthood, they're unconscious, and their origins are unconscious, and they continue to control us, but we've completely lost sight of why it came to be. And it's no longer useful. For most of us as adults, that constant judge is not any longer useful. In fact, it's harmful. It's very harmful. So then the next important thing is to see and to feel how it's harmful. How does it harm us? Many of us perhaps can say, oh yeah, we know we have this judge, but we don't really see it clearly. It's just kind of offhanded, oh yeah, oh yeah. So our task, both on and off the cushion, is to see that judge very clearly. And to see then the attendant pain, both physically and emotionally, because there is, if we pay attention to our bodies, there is definitely an effect on the body. Shoulders might be tight, might be pain in the abdomen, might be irritable bowel, might be migraines, any number of things, high blood pressure, all kinds of effects from this constant commentary, this constant judging, evaluating. Often it comes in the form of comparing. You know, we compare ourselves to somebody else, or we compare ourselves to an idea or an ideal. And, of course, that's a killer. We can never measure up. We're never going to measure up to an idea or an ideal. It's not us. We're never going to measure up to somebody else because we're not them. We're ourselves. So that literally kills something in us. It is not accepting who we are. It is negating our very nature to compare ourselves to anyone else or to an idea or ideal. And it can be very, very painful. So seeing that. In Buddhist practice, comparing is considered conceit. We are told we are not better than, we are not less than, we are not equal to. Because there's no comparison. We are each a jewel in the web of life and not to be compared. So this comparing, I say, is a killer. I think it's life-denying. It's certainly our nature-denying. So seeing where in the body this judge creates tension or pain, and allowing ourselves to experience it fully. And then recognizing the emotional pain, because there's tremendous emotional pain from living with a critic, as probably all of you know and could speak to. Allowing ourselves to experience that. That's something we don't want to do. I know I turned away from it for years because the pain was just too great. And I didn't want to face it. So there are all kinds of strategies for avoiding it. But finally, ultimately, it comes down to facing it. Facing the pain of living with that critic, of living with that judge. That's the only way that we ultimately become free. Seeing it clearly, facing the tiger, as we often say in Buddhist practice, facing what we've been avoiding for all these years, and seeing it for what it is. So then what we can see is usually what happens is we get caught up in what the judge is saying. We either believe it, we think it's true, or we defend ourselves against it. But in either case, we're totally engaged. We're totally caught up in the judge. And probably if you've seen it at all and if you pay attention, you'll see that. You know, you're either agreeing, yeah, you're right, I am no good. Or you're right, that was really stupid. I'll never make anything of myself or whatever. Each has our own flavor. Or we're defending against it. You know, that's really not true. Well, I only did that because da 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 da. It doesn't matter. In either case, we're caught up. We're engaged with the judge. And in that engagement, I mean, that could go on forever, for the rest of our lives. We would always be either agreeing or defending against the judge. So we need to shift our focus from what the judge is saying to the judge itself, to really examine the judge. Who is this judge? Where does it come from? What is going on? And not be caught up in what it's saying. Ultimately, that's irrelevant. What's important is the judge, seeing that, recognizing that. When we do, then we can disengage. And we can see how we've been living our lives with the brakes on. Maybe some of you have felt that. I certainly did. We see how it limits us, how it constricts us, how it keeps us from being fully alive, fully ourselves, fully spontaneous, and fully out in the world. I have recently been reading this book that I highly recommend. It's called Soul Without Shame. It's the best that I've seen on this very subject. This is written by a man in Berkeley who has a spiritual practice, not Buddhist, but very akin. And it's not easy reading. It's quite intense. I've had to read it slowly over a long period of time. But he really looks in depth at the judge and tells us, you know, how to become mindful of it, how to pay attention, and how to ultimately become free of the judge. So a lot of what I say comes from this book, as well as from my own experience. When we're attached to a certain way of being, or thinking that there is a certain way to be, a certain way to act in life, certain views or certain ideas about how things ought to be, how life ought to be, then we're living out of concepts and ideas and out of our head, and not from our direct experience. And that's life-denying. That's not supporting of our true nature. So, this is a reading from Almas, who is also a teacher in Berkeley and the teacher of the author of this book. He says, "We still don't understand that our attitudes, ideas, and beliefs are actually responsible for our suffering. We pay lip service to this idea, but we don't know it completely and totally. So we continue in our old patterns. The work we do here is simply to see the picture completely, seeing exactly what it is you are doing and how that affects reality. This is the way that real freedom, actual change, will come about. To live in freedom and absolute fulfillment, we need a complete, radical shift. And such a shift can occur only when there is a complete understanding of what we are actually doing. Completely, clearly seeing that judge and the effect on us. All the work you do here is based on understanding what you do and how you interfere with the natural process. If you try to do anything other than understand a situation, your effort will be a blockage, a resistance, and interference. You cannot make yourself grow. You can only cease to interfere. You cannot make yourself happy. You can only stop your judgments. Growth and expansion are natural. They are the life force itself, and you cannot predict its direction." So we say so often in this practice, right, that it's not necessary to do anything. In fact, we often want to stop our doing, because that interferes. And I think this passage sounds so hopeful, that if we just pay attention, if we just see clearly, but that takes vigilance, that takes effort, keep seeing over and over and over, on its own, things will change. There is a natural life force towards growth. And that will happen when we stop interfering. And that has certainly been my experience. Then a companion book is Radical Acceptance. Maybe some of you were here two Wednesdays ago when Tara Brock from the D.C. area, who wrote this book, was here and talked. And I find that that radical acceptance, the idea of radical acceptance, is a beautiful complement to seeing the judge. Because, of course, it's just the opposite. The judge is constantly picking at us, pointing out what's not okay, what we're doing wrong, what needs to change. And radical acceptance talks about accepting ourselves just as we are. And we make the distinction between accepting and condoning. She's not saying, and she made that very clear, she's not saying to condone certain things. Some things, you know, are not good and we don't want to condone them. But she is saying to accept ourselves just as we are. Sometimes it's said, each of us has a dharma. Each of us has something to give to the world, a life to live. And to do that, we can't be living by somebody else's standards. We can't be comparing. That doesn't make any sense. If we have our own dharma, then it's useless to compare to anybody else's. It's not going to be the same. But living our own truth, living our own dharma, can be the most fulfilling life. In my experience, what I found is that requires then a radical letting go. And for me, it has only happened over years and with a lot of struggle. I was talking with some friends yesterday and comparing it to the chicken breaking out of the egg. I struggled for years, and at the time I couldn't have even told you exactly what I was struggling with. Now I look back and I see. And I see that the struggle was important. It wasn't much fun. I wish I hadn't had to do it. But that struggle was important because I gained strength. And now I can see the value of that. Gil often talks about or compares it to rowing a boat on a placid lake. And if the water is very calm and it's an easy row, it's very nice. You have a wonderful experience. But you don't really build much muscle. But if you're rowing on a lake that's very turbulent and you really have to work hard, it might not be as much fun, but you have built a lot of stamina, a lot of muscle, and you might find that actually more valuable than the easy experience. So, what I came to see, and what Byron Brown talks about, is that when we're caught with the judge, we're caught in a victim position. We're generally trapped in the child position. And somehow I knew that, but I couldn't quite get free. In order to be free, we have to see how we're caught in being the child. And then come to recognize that we are no longer that child. We are who we are now. And that every time we get caught up with that judge, we're putting ourselves back in that child position and in some ways re-traumatizing ourselves. In some ways, perhaps digging a hole deeper, responding to that judge. We're allowing ourselves to get caught in that victim child position, which is very, very painful. And when we can see that and literally disengage from the judge and disidentify with the child, recognize it, feel it, and then not identify with the child, but identify with who we are right now, then the judge begins to lose its power. It doesn't have the same power over us as it does when we're caught. Then compassion. Compassion for ourselves is so important. And that's what Tara talked about, the two arms. We might say that the mindfulness, really seeing the judge clearly, brings wisdom. We see what we're doing. We see the pattern. We see how we're caught. That can be considered the wisdom arm. But then along with that, we need the arm of compassion. And that probably can't be stressed enough, and it can be very difficult to do when we're caught with the judge. It's almost antithetical. But we need that compassion for ourselves, for the child, maybe most especially for the child, for the judge perhaps, for ourselves now, and especially when we get caught, when we're so caught up and perhaps we can't see things clearly, we can't see a way out. Compassion for that pain, for that stuckness, for the process. And that compassion, that softening, that loving kindness, if you will, that softening of the heart can support us as we do the work. The mindfulness and the compassion can kind of go hand in hand. So we build the mindfulness at the same time we build the compassion. And the compassion helps support the mindfulness. Because if we don't have that, if we don't have the compassion, then it's dry and harsh and cold. And we're not able really to free ourselves. But with the compassion, that's kind of like the support, the underpinning, so that we can see clearly, we can do the work, and we can allow ourselves to be free. A couple more things, and then I want to hear from you. There is a beautiful kind of cause and effect relationship between truth and compassion. They go together. Compassion leads to truth, truth to compassion. And what makes us avoid either or both of them is usually pain. We want to feel good. We want to protect our beliefs, our ideas about who we are. We want to protect ourselves from seeing the truth about others. We all have these cherished beliefs about who we are, who others are, how things are supposed to be. Seeing through these could bring pain, could bring fear. But that is because we believe the lies. We think the lies are the truth because we don't trust the truth itself. But the truth itself is the point, regardless of whether it accords with our beliefs. Nothing is more powerful in combating the judge in a loving way than the heart's longing for and knowing of the truth. Where once the judge could suppress the joy with rules and standards, fear and pain, now the judge discovers that its weapons are useless against a heart that is totally carefree, more radiant than the sun, and untouched by fear. So when we have that radical acceptance, that compassion, our heart opens. We feel the joy, and the judge loses its power. The judge no longer has that sway over us. So we have a few minutes, and I'd like to hear from you if you'd be willing to share perhaps your... Perhaps your experience of the judge, perhaps your experience of working with the judge. Questions, comments?
Mm-hmm. I find your subject very apropos, of course, of just, you know, what was happening today. I guess I'm curious how you would
For me, I don't know if others hear it that way, but I hear the difference as you speak. Yeah. There's an internal knowing that most of us have about what is, we say in Buddhist practice, skillful or wise, and what is not, especially in terms of things like stealing. And that usually comes from a deeper place. It is almost a knowing. The judge tends to be up here, tends to be a running commentary. And if you look closely, often you'll see it really doesn't matter what you do. It's always commenting. You can do one thing and it'll say, oh, but you should have done the other. And you do the other and it'll say, but you should have done the first thing. It's a running evaluation of ourselves. Does that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know
right.
The difference, and I think
right.
Everyone in the room probably does. I'm concerned about where that can be taken. I don't know why I'm worrying about other people, you know, but that same thing said to a lot of people in the world would function very differently if they don't.
What I'm hearing is a lack of trust. And this is a very important part of it. It's an important part of what keeps the judge in place. We are afraid that if we don't listen to that judge, that super ego, I can't think of another word, but the superego that's constantly telling us what to do and what not to do, that we'll run amok, that we'll just, you know, do whatever, get in trouble, steal something. What we find is that's not true. That's just not true. And those that do those things are not coming from their true nature. They've been wounded. And those wounds have not been healed. And so they have the work of healing those wounds. You know, as we all do. But that's where that kind of behavior comes from. It doesn't come from our true nature. It doesn't come from that deepest place in us. Does that help?
Someone else, and I feel left out or left behind. Mm-hmm. And I know it hurts because I often feel hurt. I'm not quite sure what to do with the hurt. I mean, that's what I'm puzzled by. What steps do I go through? Other than realizing that can happen, you know, that somebody can shift allegiance or whatever, but it still hurts.
Yes.
And I'm basically feel the same way about.
It occurs to me that what can be useful in a situation like that is checking out our ideas, our views. First of all, of course, as you did, seeing, experiencing, recognizing the hurt. And why? Well, because so-and-so is seeming to be more friendly with somebody else. Underneath your feeling hurt, there's a belief. Something like, if she's feeling friendly to so-and-so, that means she doesn't like me as well.
Right.
That's the belief to question. Is that really true?
And if it is, case of, let's say, a divorce, if a husband leaves a wife for another woman, I mean, it's hard to say, is it really true that he likes so-and-so better? You know what I mean?
That's pretty complicated. There are lots of reasons people leave one person for somebody else.
Sure.
Not necessarily having strictly to do with liking somebody else better. There, you know, there can be lots of other entangling reasons. But to look really at that belief, that is that true? And you're right, there may be a time that it is true. I would say probably 99% of the time it's not true. 99% of the time, and if you look at yourself, you know, if you're friendly with so-and-so and then you become friendly with somebody else, does that take away from this person? No, it's just an addition. You like this person for the things he or she offers. You like this person for the things he or she offers. It's not a detraction. It's often an enhancement. It's augmenting. But we have this fear or this belief, and I would guess this is the judge, uh-oh, look out. She's paying attention to somebody else. That means she doesn't care about you. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard not to take it personally.
Well, and then sometimes maybe there's a reason,
and
maybe it can be valuable to check it out. Mm-hmm. But then again, even if it's true, even if you check it out and she says, yes, that's right.
then
if you're feeling hurt, having difficulty with that, and I'm not saying you're any different from anybody else, but when we are, then to look at the belief under that. If so-and-so doesn't like me as well as she used to or likes so-and-so better, what does that say about me? And the truth is, nothing. Nothing. It says something about her. But that's where the judge jumps in and says, uh-oh, well, you're not smart enough or you're not friendly enough or you said such and such that time, no wonder she doesn't like you, or whatever, you know, it just goes on and on.
But when you say it says something about her, you don't mean in a judgmental sense, because then that would be the judge defending it.
That's right.
She's not loyal as I am, or she's not as so. It just means that maybe she's moved on in a way that I haven't or something. But
that's right. Or maybe she can have multiple friends and doesn't feel that one detracts from another or that there's any kind of comparison or...
So where do you put the hurt then? That's still, I guess, what I'm getting at.
You don't put it anywhere.
Well,
hopefully.
Or get beyond it or to move on.
Well, hopefully, yeah, that's the point of this practice. When we see things clearly, and that can take some time, granted, that's not necessarily fast, but... When we see things clearly, when we see through our beliefs, our automatic beliefs and ideas, things open up. And in general, the hurt falls away. There's no reason to be hurt because we have seen that what we're believing, what we're telling ourselves, isn't true. We take it for truth. That's the thing to see, that we have an idea and we take it for truth. It's not necessarily at all. In fact, usually it's not. Soul Without Shame. Byron Brown.
Thank you.
I got it at East West, and it's probably other places too. Yeah.
I was going to ask, from a parent's perspective, I can understand, you know, you were talking about childhood and maybe parents being acting one way, looking out the best for their children. But as a parent myself, it's hard not to give your child your own judgments about things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, as a grown-up, having been raised by parents,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are issues you deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm asking is, there's no time for this, but basically, how do you be non-judgmental. I mean, I know, I understand and can internalize what you're saying about being judgmental about yourself and judging yourself, but how do you interact with a person, whether it be a 10-year-old or a 50-year-old, without placing your own judgments on them, having them, you know, basically a 10-year-old, how do you tell a 10-year-old, you know, well, that's for you to figure out, you know? I'm not judging you. I mean, you know, as you said, there are reasons to establish good and bad when you're raising a child.
Except I would steer away from good and bad. Yeah. Right. A concept that comes up a lot in Buddhist practice is the difference between judging and discriminating mind. And the discriminating mind of wisdom is very important. And that's what helps us to see what's skillful, what's not skillful, what's useful, what's not, what's loving, what's not. Yeah. Different from the judging mind. That says, that's good, that's not. That's correct, that's not. That kind of, you know, good, bad, right, wrong kind of thing. And I think with children, you can teach or let them know what your values are without being real judgmental. And probably watching your own judgments is the biggest help. You know, seeing that judgment when it comes up and then hopefully catching ourselves, or if it comes out, then correcting ourselves. You know, kids learn that we're human, and to correct is fine. In fact, it teaches. I tried very hard with my daughter to do that, and what I would do often is ask her questions. You know, if it was a situation that I had some strong feelings about and she seemed to be seeing it differently. You know, I would just dialogue with her and ask her some questions. How do you think that person felt? Or, you know, how was that for you? Or what do you think about that? Or those kinds of things that would help her to come to see for herself, oh, maybe that wasn't so skillful, or that wasn't so useful. Yeah. But probably being aware of our own judgments is the most important. Otherwise, we just unconsciously pass them on. And along with that, our behavior. Because our behavior, as you probably all know, speaks louder than words, especially with kids. They really get that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Would you say that judging mind is malleable?
Is malleable? Usually it's not. It's pretty rigid. Usually the judge has very strong opinions and doesn't hesitate to share them. I think a more malleable mind is an open mind.
So from I guess I was just speculating on whether from a meditation, from being in meditation, engaged with the judging mind, it can be re-educated. Given that...
The mind can be re-educated?
Well, the judging mind, if you will. Mm-hmm. Judging mind be brought into present time, in fact, it's all learned behavior, you know, come back to haunt us, right? As opposed to some sort of attempt to disengage completely.
I got lost right there. Because my point would be to let go of the judge altogether, not to re-educate the judge. I'm suggesting the judge is not useful. That we can have discriminating wisdom, that we can live perfectly ethical and compassionate lives without the judge. So I would not want to re-educate the judge. I would want to let the judge fall away.
So you would say that it's within the realm of possibility to let go of the judging mind?
That's not to say that the judge wouldn't be there, but it wouldn't have the same effect. You know, like so many things, they may not go away totally, but they just don't have the same power over us. Yeah, yeah. It's like Ram Dass said, I think, you know, after all his years of spiritual practice and therapy and et cetera, he said, I still have all the same can't remember his word, whatever, faults as I used to. He said, they just don't bother me so much. So it's kind of that. I mean, there is conditioning, and conditioning is strong. So it may, unless we become, you know, arhats, totally enlightened, maybe it falls away then. But before that, it may not go completely away. But it doesn't have the same effect. We don't have to. We can see it as the Buddha did on the night of his enlightenment, you know, when Mara came to visit him, came to tempt him. And he said, I see you, Mara. You know, Mara still came, but he didn't have the same effect. The Buddha was able to say, I see you. So the judge comes up, and we might say, I see you, judge. And in that, it doesn't have the same effect.
I was struck by what you said about effort being an impediment. And I know in my own experience, my own struggle with my critic, I often find myself frustrated, feeling like until I sort of put insight into practice, I haven't really accomplished anything. And just wondering what else you could say about that.
I think what I said was the doing. You know, that it's not necessary to do. Effort is a tricky thing, because in our culture, so many of us weigh over effort, and that gets in the way. That's not useful. Yet, to be very mindful and to bring the kind of mindfulness that we need to see clearly, there certainly has to be a vigilance. And, you know, some people say that's effort and some people say it's not. Whatever it is, that vigilance, that willingness to repeatedly, over and over and over again, see clearly, see clearly, see clearly. That seems essential. And probably for some of us that might take more effort than for others. But it's been useful to me not to see it as effort, but to see it as vigilance. Vigilance, paying attention. And I saw within myself a real, sometimes resistance to that vigilance. I could be very well intentioned, but I don't know, it was sort of like being pulled back in the trance or being drawn back into it, that it was a long struggle to get that vigilance. There was something so powerful. We can call it a trance or we can call it conditioning, same thing, familiar, whatever, that would just keep drawing me back. And I'd be very vigilant, you know, and of course determined that I was going to be, and then the next thing I know, I was pulled back and pulled back. You know, it's just like the mind wandering. You have to keep coming back. That's what I found I had to do. And I was astounded at the power of that pull. Very seductive, extremely seductive. Even though I knew I was happier and more free and wanted to be in a clear state, the power of that trance was incredible. I say was. It's not that it's totally gone, but it doesn't have that same power anymore. And this is quite recent, I want you to know. And you heard Mark say that I've been meditating since 1986, so it doesn't have to take that long for everybody. For other people, it takes longer. For some people, it takes a whole lot less. But, yeah, that's the power of that conditioning, of that trance that I ultimately came to see as the judge.
I'm having a little trouble figuring out what's the judging mind and what is just ordinary wisdom that gets me through life. You know, you're always judging, you're always making decisions, you're always listening to this voice and that voice and the other voice, and you have to just, you know, protect you from getting run over in traffic, if nothing else, you know. But that's not the kind of judging you're talking about.
No, I'm not. Do you, Dick? Do you really, at this stage, have to think about not running into traffic? Oh, come on. I don't buy that for a moment.
I'm assuming you remember that I'm a bicyclist, not a driver of a car.
Right, right. But you don't just willy-nilly run into traffic.
No, but I'm hyper-vigilant, if you want to call it that, instead of judging
Of the traffic.
It's just a
different word. You're vigilant. You're vigilant of the traffic around you, right?
And what might come out of the next driveway?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't call that the judging mind.
You wouldn't?
No. No. That's...
What about when I'm trying to decide who am I going to vote for in the next election? Is this not judging? Judging mind?
No. That's discriminating wisdom, hopefully.
That's my problem.
Yeah. Somebody handed me a card earlier. Seems appropriate.
Okay.
Listen to your inner voice. Your wisdom is talking to you.
But it's not your judging mind.
Right.
What about the camouflage?
That's right.
And the mask and all that?
That's the judging mind. Oh. Yeah. And your inner voice, probably, you know, is deep. It's not here. Most of us don't point to our head when we talk about our inner voice. We usually point belly or chest or some or don't point. Yeah, yeah. But you would agree it's not here, right? Your inner voice. Not generally, but the judge resides here. The judge is that running commentary that says, Dick, that don't do that. That doesn't look good. Don't say that. Oh, that was really stupid, Dick. Don't talk like that. You know, you really ought to pay more attention. You almost got hit that time.
Did. How about what I did?
Then the judge said, see, I told you should have been more vigilant. I told you should have paid attention. That's the judge. But the mind that says, okay, now I know I'm downtown Palo Alto. There's a lot of traffic. There's cars coming out of these driveways. I'm going to be very aware. That's not the judge. That's... discriminating wisdom.
I find there is a gray zone, really.
Yeah.
The reality of it is that I can't tell you what it really should be called. It's not wearing a sign, you know. It's kind of arbitrary whether I call it this or that or the other thing.
I don't think it is, Dick. I would urge you to really pay attention.
I am.
Continue.
Confusion remains.
Yeah.
What am I to say?
Because I think you'll find there is a difference between that wisdom that says, I need to be vigilant, I need to pay attention, I don't want to get hit, and the mind that says,
sometimes it's nothing at all. Of course, it's trivial. It's easy. But what about the times when it's not trivial? It's genuinely confusing.
The judge is confusing? Or it's confusing whether it's the judge or discriminating?
Whether it's this or that or the other thing.
I think if you really look closely, you'll see the difference.
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Maybe more.
Maybe very often.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's something that you have to pay attention to. And see over and over. For you, perhaps the judging mind, the critic, has gotten so interwoven, it's so much a part of you, that it's difficult to see the difference between that judge that's yapping all the time and discriminating wisdom, or just knowing what is skillful. That's how the judge
is. For you, it's always clear?
It wasn't always clear. I think it's pretty clear now. Yeah. If something says, you know, be careful, and there's a good reason, that's very different from or you shouldn't have said that, or, you know, that was really stupid, or on and on and on. Yeah.
I think he doesn't have a judging mind.
Maybe not. Well, I think it's just about. Oh, you have.
Yeah, I was just going to say, do you find hypnotherapy helpful?
Do I find what?
Hypnotherapy helpful in undoing some of the unuseful beliefs or whatever. Some of the things that. Because I gather you're saying that we kind of come up with this belief from our childhood. Mm-hmm.
I don't do hypnotherapy myself. I think it can be useful. Mm-hmm. Sure, there are times when, you know, for whatever reasons, things are very, very far from memory, and certainly it has its place. Yeah. In this practice, of course, what we stress is the mindfulness, paying attention. But over the years, I have certainly discovered that as valuable as I find mindfulness, and it's extremely valuable, certainly other things have been helpful also, and I have needed other things. I couldn't rely just strictly on mindfulness. So, yeah, whatever works, whatever helps. Okay, it's 9 o'clock, but let's sit quietly for just a minute.